Welcome in, everyone, to Redacted on this Wednesday evening. I hope you're doing well. I'm Clayton Morris. Natalie is not here because our five-year-old got sick this afternoon, not feeling well. And we were just thinking about, hey, it's summertime. We normally get one of those like summer colds, you know, like where you, you know, it happens every summer. It's like a summer flu.
Or monkeypox, right?
I don't think so. I don't think it's either of those things. I hope it's neither of those things. But we've all had COVID like multiple times, right? So so who cares? You know, who gives a rat's ass at this point? She's not feeling well, so she's been sick all day. So Natalie is on mom patrol watching her cleaning up from that stuff. So so you've got me and David and Philip and the crew here tonight solo. We've got a jam-packed show for you today. We've got a lot of news to get to. Big developments out of Ukraine over the past 24 hours, which we'll cover. We're going to talk about we entering a dangerous new phase in Ukraine, specifically in Crimea. Russia now amassing a number of forces along the Ukrainian border for what looks like a massive offensive that's about to unfold. It looks like Putin's had enough of these attacks with American HIMARS and others. We're also going to look at the latest on the nuclear power plant. Scott Ritter saying there's something very, very big going on that the Western media is not covering, and we will cover it here on this show. We're also going to look at this massive vaccine lawsuit. You know, last night we were actually talking about this on the show. Why haven't we seen more of these vaccine lawsuits come through? We saw it in Canada, right, where we actually got documents from the Canadian government, and we knew that they were lying. And so now, I said last night on the show, I think I said this, because I told my wife, I said, didn't I say that? Because, you know, you want to get credit for it, right? Honey, didn't I say this? And she said, oh, yes, you did say that. And I said, I want to see if we're going to see bigger lawsuits, maybe in the United States, where class action or otherwise, where people were forced to or were told they couldn't work at a place because they had to get the vaccine. What's going to come of these lawsuits? Well, aha, we have our first massive lawsuit that has revealed some very interesting details. We're going to get to that. We're also going to talk about this massive cover-up in Afghanistan. It's 1 year later. We've left that country in total disarray. So we will look at the very latest on this, what the House Select Committee is saying, House Committee is saying about the United States and the cover-up, and what did we do inside of that country when we left? Did the Biden administration lie about it? We'll throw that out to you. Do you think the Biden administration lied about it? And we're also going to look about into Europe, but specifically on Germany, because officials there are saying, get ready for a cold winter. Get ready for an energy crisis throughout Europe, thanks to sanctions on Russia and the reduction in the amount of nuclear power that Germany has specifically undertaken over the past few years in order for this green energy initiative. It has completely backfired. We have an expert on the show tonight to talk about some of his latest journalism and research on this subject about Germany and the deep state's new world order pulling back all of this, the purpose of it, right, to try to make us collapse, to have this massive energy collapse across the world so that they can, of course, come in and put install their green ideology, their green plan for energy. It's collapsing and it's backfiring on them. And we're going to take a much closer look at all of that and more as Redacted starts right now. Someone says, man, the show's not the same without that sexy co-host. And I'm not talking about the white glasses guy either. Hey, I get it. Yeah, Natalie's not here. My five-year-old is sick, so she is she's taking care of her tonight and putting her to bed and getting her situated. So it's an all-hands-on-deck situation. It's one of those like late, and then you just wait for it. You just wait for it to go through the whole house, you know? It's like you're all just kind of waiting. It's like a gas leak. You're kind of like, all right, who's getting it next? Right? We all know how that goes, right? She's sick.
Yeah.
And I'm like asking my other kids, I'm like, are you sick? Are you feeling bad now? Are you walking around here with a headache? Are you, what's the deal?
Where the family's like, where is Dad? He's up in the spire. He's trying to stay away from the sickness.
I know. I've got the studio in the upper part of the house. It's away from everybody. Yeah.
You're in the spire up there, just like sitting there with your, going like this. I'm not going to get sick.
Like in a Zelda game. You know, the problem is, though, with guys, well, for me, what happens is that I'll start getting sick usually like a day later. But no one wants to hear about dad getting sick, right? No one, because I'm like, yeah, I'm starting to get a little headache. And my wife will be like, you have to allow me to be sick. I was the one who was sick first. So I need to be given all of the carte blanche to be sick. And then it's like a day later, I get sick. You know, you can't stop it. Hey, we've got a daily newsletter. I hope you read it. It's totally free. It's delivered to your inbox first thing in the morning. We had a really good newsletter today. Again, you can read it in about 5 or 10 minutes over your cup of coffee first thing in the morning. If you go to redacted.inc, it's redacted.inc, not .com, and then just sign up, and then you'll receive a welcome email from me. And my email is clayton@redacted.inc. So just drag it over to your VIP or your contacts. Otherwise, Google has labeled us dangerous. So we're not dangerous. We just cover the facts. We cover the news on this show. So you got to drag us over into your contacts list. That way you'll get the newsletter. We do it Monday through Friday, so you'll get it every day of the week in your inbox. So don't let Google tell you that we're dangerous. All right, shall we kick things off? Let's dive into our top story tonight, which is Ukraine. We are entering a dangerous new phase in the war on Ukraine, and specifically peace negotiations, which of course have been shelved, pushed off. We've been pushing for peace, right? We knew that peace was on the table, but was completely sidetracked when Boris Johnson from the UK, at the behest of the United States, flew in to meet with Zelensky and said, no peace negotiations. Now, Ukraine appears to be pushing for total destruction of its country by planning attacks in Crimea, which we will get to in a minute. We're going to get to Crimea in a minute. But first, stunning revelations this afternoon that the United States is committing war crimes. The United States is committing war crimes. Now, you'll say, Clayton, we know this. The United States does this all the time. It's been doing it in country after country after country, right? It did it in Afghanistan. It did it in Iraq. It's done it in Syria. It's been doing it in Ukraine. And we're going to have the stunning revelations this afternoon that the United States is committing war crimes inside Ukraine by coordinating and attacking the largest nuclear power plant in Europe. Yes, I said the United States. Using American-made HIMARS to attack nuclear power plants. Now, I've spoken to NATO sources who've told me specifically, and we've confirmed this with separate military sources, and we've featured this here on the show over the past few months, right, to operate HIMARS. First of all, the United States doesn't trust the Ukrainians to operate them themselves. So we've been essentially operating them. And of course, we're providing all of the intelligence data to make the HIMARS targets effective. And you need to have that massive coordination. And all of that is being carried out in Kyiv. Go ahead.
Well, and that's exactly why I still don't understand why people call this a proxy war. This is not a proxy war. We are every bit as involved as Ukraine is.
Yeah, I know. And maybe we should abandon that term, kind of come back to it, because, you know, we don't have tens of thousands of Americans who are there literally as infantry on the ground. But still, we're running the show. It's American weapons, it's American tax dollars, and Americans calling the shots, the intelligence. We're going to get to the Crimea part of this, which is clearly an American intelligence operation. But specifically on the nuclear power plants. So Scott Ritter explained this to Bradley Wasser today or overnight. And Ritter points out that the Western media has been totally silent on this issue. Listen to him explain and lay this out in perfect detail how the United States is committing war crimes in Ukraine. Listen.
The other things that emerge from this is the role played by the United States. And I think this is an underappreciated aspect to the story. You know, the initial attack against this facility took place on August 5th, but it was preceded by an August 1st presentation made by Secretary of State Tony Blinken, in which he highlighted this facility and he began to create the mythology of Russian irresponsibility, talking about how Russia had turned this facility into a nuclear shield and that Russia was using this facility as a base to carry out attacks against the Ukrainians, knowing that the Ukrainians would never strike back, et cetera. No evidence was provided to sustain this. But what Blinken did is create the beginning of this narrative that says that the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant and the territory around it must be removed from Russian control and turned over to international control, which would lead to the Ukrainians taking control. This is what the whole thing is about. So we know that the United States played a role in helping shape this narrative, which was then acted on by a Ukrainian attack. Now, the initial attacks appear to have been done by munitions that are under the control of the Ukrainian army exclusively. But the most recent attack appears to have been undertaken by a HIMARS rocket. And what's important about this is that, as the deputy head of Ukrainian intelligence for the Kyiv district, and the reason why that's important is the Kyiv district, of course, is the region that interfaces most directly with the United States and NATO in terms of intelligence provision and command and control support, etc., said that nothing happens with the HIMARS unless it's directed to by the United States. So if a HIMARS was fired by Ukrainians against the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, that means it was done not only with permission and approval of the United States, but the active participation, since the United States provides the targeting intelligence that's used to support HIMARS operations. This means the United States is by proxy attacking Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. This is a war crime. It's a war crime of the highest order. And I don't understand why the U.S. government's getting a free pass on this, why the media is being quiet about this.
That's a great question. When do we ever not get a free pass? I mean, we get a free pass on the things, the atrocities we do all over the world. Somehow, we always end up getting a free pass.
And that's why we're covering it here on our show. Now, I wish, now we have 10,000 or so people watching us live, and hundreds of thousands more will watch us later. And you know, again, we're small potatoes compared to, you know, when you could have literally the Western media, you could have the Associated Press if it wasn't an extension of the intelligence state in the United States. You could have Reuters if it wasn't an extension of the intelligence state. You could have the BBC if it wasn't an extension of the deep state intelligence state controlling things, covering these stories. And you won't. We showed you the British missiles that were found, right? We showed you the shelling, the British shell casings, right? We showed you these things at the power plant. Then we showed you, you know, the evidence, of course, of HIMARS attacks on these. And there's no, the Western media will not cover it. Where's the Wall Street Journal? Where are any Western journalists covering this story? They're not. They're kept at an arm's length, and Ukraine doesn't want them anywhere nearby. They're kept totally away from these stories. They're kept totally out of the, you know, they're not allowed to go to anywhere near Eastern Ukraine. They're not allowed to touch these stories. And these foreign
these foreign desks
hand out information to them, and they cover it from New York City. They don't actually go there. You have very few journalists like Eva Bartlett, Vanessa Bealey, Kavor Kalmassian, Patrick Lancaster, and others who are physically there covering this story. George Alassian, who actually physically see it. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, and then what they do is they marginalize those people. They label them conspiracy theorists, and then they end up on kill lists by the Ukrainian government. And so it's like, The only information you can really get is from those people on the ground that are actually there reporting stuff, not the people that are here in their office just trying to control a narrative, because where are they getting their information?
Right. And we had a journalist who was just killed in eastern Ukraine, in Donbass, over the past 24 hours or so, on her way to cover part of the story and ran over a Ukraine-planted mine. Of course, we've been covering the petal mines that have been blasted all over the place in the Donbass by the Ukrainian army. And of course, those are a violation of the Ottawa Convention. These mines that have been planted all over the place should have been cleared up. And by the way, the United States actively involved in the, first of all, the knowledge on the State Department's website, knowledge of these mines, which are a violation of the Geneva Convention. They are a war crime. And yet we are actively funneling money to people that are carrying out known war crimes. And then we ourselves are carrying out war crimes. And the American taxpayers are being lied to And, you know, last night we did this little dog and pony show where you had President Biden signing this Inflation Reduction Act, which is not going to reduce inflation at all for Americans. It's a total boondoggle for big businesses and the military industrial complex. It's not going to help Americans at all, but it's okay that we support this charade in Ukraine. Tulsi Gabbard talked specifically about this, and she had a comment specifically about, like, first of all, the sanctions, which haven't been working at all, but how this is all part of the plan from the very beginning. This was all part of the plan to develop this new liberal world order, which Joe Biden talked about. Listen to Tulsi.
Now, despite their lectures and their crocodile tears, it's never been about morality. It's not about the people of Ukraine or protecting democracy. This is about regime change in Russia and exploiting this war to strengthen NATO and feed the military-industrial complex. Now, to Joe Biden, it's even about bringing about, quote, a new world order. We've got to lead it, he says. And he's trying to do just that, even if it means bringing us to the brink of nuclear catastrophe.
Yeah. So here's the way you bring us to the brink of nuclear catastrophe. You literally use American HIMARS and fire them at the largest nuclear power plant in all of Europe. And you hope that people won't notice. No wonder you don't want international inspectors to go there and see it. I mean, I can't imagine a bigger story. So, you know, Zero Hedge actually had a really interesting breakdown of the number of what nuclear war would look like and what a nuclear fallout would look like. 5 billion people would die from famine alone. Let's go through this. My screen here. If tensions between Russia and the United States spark an all-out nuclear war between the two rivals, more than 5 billion people would die from hunger alone, according to a new study. Scientists at Rutgers University projected, listen to this, the amount of soot that would be thrust into the Earth's atmosphere in a variety of nuclear war scenarios. Variety of nuclear war. So you might say, oh, well, they're not using weapons. It's just a nuclear power plant. No, this is a variety. It doesn't matter, right? It's fissile material. This is what would happen. Between India and Pakistan, they studied this, to a full-blown war between Russia and the United States. A relatively modest Indo-Pakistani war would slash the world's average caloric output by 7% within the first 5 years. Bigger than any disruption humanity has faced thus far, it says. Even for a regional nuclear war, large parts of the world may suffer famine, according to the study's authors. The biggest U.S.-Russian exchange would positively devastate global food production, shrinking it 90% in 3 to 4 years after the explosions cease. 75% of human beings would be dead in 2 years. And they just want to play with this? These guys just want to play with this. In addition to lower crop yields, the Rutgers models attempted to account for export restrictions as well as mitigation efforts such as humans, livestock, feed, and to eat. A devastating picture as the study presents. The ozone layer would be destroyed by heating of the stratosphere, producing more ultraviolet radiation at the surface. So, again, all of these and all of this to say that the United States is playing with fire right now as it considers continuing to attack a nuclear power plant in order to, I don't know what, to provoke what. Again, we know that Ukraine is being used as a playground to test these weapons and to destroy all of Ukraine. That's what's going to happen. We have a story that we're going to be covering tomorrow, why a huge swath of Ukrainian land is now owned, not by Ukrainians, but by United States and multinational corporations. Over almost two-thirds bought up the land. Now, will it be worthless
land? It's another place where they can hide their money, they can hide their things, because it's completely outside of U.S. law. That's what I felt all along. I felt like There's a reason those biolabs were there. There's a reason they were hiding it. There's a reason that, like, look at what we did in Afghanistan. That was basically just a cash cow for all of these companies, and they're going to do the same thing now in Ukraine. We're going to be there indefinitely, and we're going to make a bunch of money until we find the next place that we can do it once the American people start realizing and ask us to leave and get out of there, stop sending them all this money. But right now, we're at the beginning phase, and how much have we sent already that we have no accounting for? I mean, are we like 200 billion yet? Like, how much is it? It's probably over that.
Oh, and we're seeing these weapons, of course, that are, you know, being sold all over the black market. We showed you the video yesterday, the Moscow weapons show, where they have literal American weapons on display showing, hey, don't buy these because these are garbage compared to what we've got. Oh, and we're able to buy them on the black market. So that's why they're featured here at this weapons expo. Like, that's your tax dollars at work flowing right in there. Meanwhile, I want to talk about Crimea because huge news out of Crimea and this offensive that Vladimir Putin could be mounting any moment now. Now, the last time we saw a large array of forces, we saw the invasion of Ukraine, right? Now, there appears to be a total plan of destruction of its country by planning attacks in Crimea. And this appears to be why President Putin of Russia is saying, no more, I've had enough. And about to launch this massive invasion of Ukraine. So overnight, another round of explosions happening against Russian military installations. So these are Russian military installations here in Crimea. So take a look at your screen. There's a number of them happening. Now, this is really interesting strategy because the United States doesn't want Ukraine to use NATO weapons to attack inside Russia. Okay, follow me on this. But Crimea isn't recognized as Russian by NATO. You follow me? So even though it is, right, Russia annexed Crimea, it is. An overwhelming number of people that lived in this area are happy to be Russian, right? We've shown you the polls. We know that this is the case. So having a NATO-led assault of Crimea gets them off the hook because it's not technically Russian soil. See what I mean? You follow me? Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. So over the past few days, we've seen these explosions. So, we're not attacking inside of Russia. This is Crimea. We're going, you know, reclaiming our sovereign territory, right? That's the argument. Never mind that the people there are ethnic Russians and don't want to be a part of Ukraine. Forget that piece of it. And forget that this is a violation of the Minsk agreements. Forget that piece as well. So over the past few
barely
days...
barely an inconvenience.
Yeah, exactly. So far, we've seen over the past few days a series of explosions hitting Russian ammunition depots. And we've shown you the video here and aircraft hangars. At first, it appeared that it was because of Russian safety issues that somehow some of this ammunition, I don't know, caught fire and then went off, right? That was the initial report last week that... Well, it didn't seem like it was anything Ukrainian. Like, how are they launching an attack? And Russians weren't going to be attacking themselves, even though the Western media likes to say that. So then who the hell is this? It must have been a safety problem, and some of this ammunition went off like fireworks, like it was a mistake. Well, now when more and more of these pop up, it's no longer it's not a coincidence anymore that this is not safety concerns. So Russia calls these explosions in Crimea, now they're calling them sabotage. According to the Washington Post, that's exactly what they are. Special forces attacking Russia in Crimea. See, Crimea ammunition depot blast is a work of Ukraine special forces. Now, I don't buy that for a second. I don't think for a second that these are Ukrainian special forces. I mean, maybe they're special forces that were trained by the United States Special Forces with the help of the United States Special Forces that are in there coordinating these sabotage attacks. But the idea that these are Ukrainian special forces totally on their own without any help from anyone and they're just going in and doing this, I don't buy that for a second. And neither should you. So these attacks now being carried out by Ukrainian special forces with the help fully of the United States and NATO to target these munitions depots inside of Crimea. Why do you think suddenly Vladimir Putin is amassing an enormous number of aircraft and vehicles to go into, these are the Russian arm amassing forces here. Let's put this up on the screen. About 430 Russian aircraft, 36, 360 helicopters concentrated around Ukraine. The number of helicopters used by the Russian Federation against Ukraine has significantly increased to the over 360 now, and these are amassing right along the border area now. Not surprising. Provoking the bear. And of course, Zelensky said this was going to happen, right? We want to retake Crimea. This is a message he made to Olaf Scholz of Germany and to Boris Johnson of the UK. In an interview with The Guardian, Mikhail Podolyak, who's an advisor to Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky, says they plan to destroy the Crimean Bridge. Now, the Crimean Bridge, he says, is a huge mistake because it is Russia should have never built this large bridge, which is the largest bridge in Europe, by the way. And now we're going to attack it. He says it's Russia should have never built it, that it's an aid vessel. It's a way to deliver aid and military, military pieces, munitions, etc., into Crimea. So we're going to attack the largest bridge. So we need to take it out. It's illegal, so we're going to take it out. So watch that to happen, the Crimean Bridge to be blown up, and then watch these attacks unfolding. Again, military experts we've spoken to believe this is a massive Russian offensive that's about to unfold. So get ready. So any of these HIMARS that are still floating around out there, and any of these leftover American sites that are floating around out there are going to be on the target list. Very, very shortly. And you, by the way, I should mention that Ukraine is now telling its own citizens to get out of Crimea. If there's any Ukrainian citizens in Crimea, to leave. That's a warning. So, and now the United Nations heading to Ukraine as well to try to tamp down some of these tensions. But we've got multiple pieces that are inflaming, that could inflame the world here with this nuclear power plant attack and what happens in Crimea. Because Putin is not going to take that lightly, and we could be looking at a massive buildup of military force in the next few days, if not in the next, few hours, actually. So we'll be watching that. I should also point out the Washington Post has this amazing story this afternoon, and I want to pull it up here. Americans are paying for slogans on bombs aimed at Russians. So think about this for a second. Americans are paying for slogans to be written on bombs that are being aimed at Russians. Now, what is this story about? And this is just an example, right? And they're putting these up on GoFundMe pages. And so if you want to, donate thousands of dollars, you can absolutely do that. And you can get a message that you, the Ukrainian army will print on arguably the missiles that you've provided anyway. And the idea is that they're raising money to help the war effort. Now, reading through the tweets on this, the responses, like so many Americans are like, yes, way to stick it to them. Where can I sign up? How can I donate money? Can you believe this? And then other people saying, what are you, crazy? Like, literally, they're going to use these to maybe shell Eastern Ukraine. Like you're going to put your name on a missile that's going to be, or it's going to be blown up by Russia anyway. And by the way, you already paid for it. So they're raising money with, you're going to donate money to a GoFundMe so you can put a message on these missiles. The fundraising effort, it's raised so far. The Washington Post says it's raised $150,000 for the Ukrainian military. And it says there's all sorts of messages that people have donated, like from NATO with love, or London says hello, and remember the Alamo.
The disgusting thing is people don't realize that some of those are going to hit children. Some of those are going to hit, mm-hmm. innocent people. And it's like they don't care. After their little sign is on it, and after they get their whatever satisfaction they get out of that, it's out of their hands, and that could be killing innocent people, and they probably don't even care.
Yeah, exactly.
As long as they're Russian.
The most expensive item on the website is the naming rights to a Russian-made T-72 tank for $3,000. So you could put your name written on the side of that. And there's others. Here's just let me see if I can find the... there are more photos. There were more photos, but But you can see these different howitzer. This is a God bless the USA, glory to Ukraine. Here it is on a side of a rocket. Sign My Rocket is the GoFundMe. Now, imagine if this was done in reverse, how quickly GoFundMe would take this site down, right? Like, you're literally promoting the killing of people, right? Like, isn't that some sort of a violation of terms of service, you would think?
Only if you're promoting killing the wrong people. You know what I mean? As long as you're promoting killing the right people, then all is good, I guess.
I mean, I think they're using the back end of GoFundMe. Here is the website. Send your message to the Russian invaders at signmyrocket.com. Oh, and you can use PayPal and Venmo. So you can use PayPal and Venmo. And PayPal and Venmo, by the way, have sent messages to YouTube channels. I mean, all sorts of different YouTube channels that are anti-war. And they've stopped allowing you to use Venmo and PayPal for your community and all of that. Like, if you've got a community, if you're a YouTuber and otherwise, like, PayPal will send you a note. Basically, we're done. Based on your content, we're shutting you down. But it's okay. Sign My Rocket.
Now, PayPal. I want to make sure
PayPal supported.
I want to make sure I fully understand this. So PayPal and Venmo will go after sex workers, and like, even banks will like completely cut off their accounts for taking money, you know, even for like having an OnlyFans or something like that. But so getting naked, bannable on Venmo and PayPal, blowing people up, A-okay. I just want to make sure that I've got that. Okay.
It's totally fine with PayPal and Venmo. Yeah, totally fine with that. And I love, like, literally right on the front of the website, they make no mistake about what they're going to do. You have a chance to kill orcs with your text written on an artillery shell that will be fired at Russian soldiers. Like, they're not hiding what this is.
Well, I'm looking at the source code of the page, and it says, we accept donations via PayPal, Apple Pay, Google Pay, Visa, MasterCard, Ethereum, and Bitcoin, meaning that Apple, PayPal, and Google Pay, and Visa, and MasterCard don't care about this. Like, they're going to, like Philip said, they're going to not accept payments for porn, but for murdering potentially innocent people, go for it.
Yeah. Now, to be fair, I don't know, like, what sort of, you know, policing, you know, like, Google Pay has out there and whatever, and Visa and MasterCard, right? But, like, we've absolutely seen that PayPal and Venmo have been proactive. Like, they've been actively going after people who are anti-war, who are telling the truth about what's happening in this war. They've been actively shutting them down, canceling them. So they have a team that's devoted to, like, going after people like this. But they're not doing it here. I mean, talk about a double standard. But this is what's happening. You know, you can sign your weapons that are going to be, taking out soldiers, putting your name on it. One person in the article that was highlighted literally got this for his wife for an anniversary gift. Let's see if I can find that. Yeah, here it is. Colin Smith of Dallas purchased the slogan on this artillery shell for his wife for their anniversary. Colin and whatever his wife's name is, established 2021. Isn't that sweet, honey? I got you a missile that's going to be used to take out people. Do you like that? No, I don't, honey. CNY, established in 20. He said she loved it, though she's kind of now tired of me telling her about the war. But she did love it. I hope this shell went to a good cause. I hope it went to, continued shelling of villages and hurting people. Unbelievable. We've got more news to get to here on the show. Yeah?
Really quick, I just wanted to say, so I've gone through the source code of the site. It is a custom coded site, so it doesn't have a back end like GoFundMe or anything like that, but it is, the address is in Ukraine. Bloglovistyanyas 170, Dubova Ivana Yurivna is the name of the person. So it is a custom coded website from Ukraine. So great. Just FYI.
We've got more news to get to here on the show. We're going to be looking at this massive vaccine lawsuit. You're going to want to pay attention to that. It's really, really troubling and eye-opening and quite shocking. And maybe we actually get some more of these. We can only hope. We're also going to look at the cover-up in Afghanistan on the withdrawal of American forces there. Did the Biden administration lie about how many Americans were left in Afghanistan? We'll bring you that story. We're also going to look at Germany's energy crisis, Europe's energy crisis, as the deep state, as the World Economic Forum, and all of these unelected billionaires have been pushing for us to have an energy crisis. This is all part of the plan. Like, they want middle class and poor people to suffer. They want you to pay more so that you're forced to get off of their fossil fuels and move towards their green energy initiatives. And it's coming home to roost in Germany. We're going to talk about that coming up in just a moment. First, I want to tell you about our friends at ScoreMaster while we take a quick pause, get some coffee. Don't go anywhere. The three-week rule may be the best financial advice ever. What is the three-week rule? Well, wait 3 weeks to buy that new car, wait 3 weeks to refinance your home, and wait 3 weeks to finance any major purchase. Why 3 weeks? Because that's how fast the average ScoreMaster user takes to boost his or her credit score. Did you know David actually did this too? You can actually raise your credit score by up to 61 points, an average of 61 points and more to your credit score in a short amount of time. These guys are amazing.
Yeah, for me, it was like a 2 month. So in 2 months, it changed it so that my interest rate went from like a 12% to like a 5%.
It's amazing. So ScoreMaster technology was developed by credit data scientists. Now, I'm friends with the CEO of this company, and he made it his mission to help people because he was just stunned to see, specifically in his family, how this was crushing people based on stuff that was on the credit report that shouldn't have been there. So you can do this. You can get your credit score higher and faster than you ever thought possible using ScoreMaster. And the way that you do this, you're going to get a free 7-day trial by going to scoremaster.com/redacted. It takes about a minute to sign up. They have all sorts of great tools there. Even if you don't use their service long term, just go there and get the free stuff, okay? And try it out. It's a game changer. That's scoremaster.com/redacted. It's right there on your screen. scoremaster.com/redacted to get your 7-day trial that we negotiated for you so you can do that. I want to thank all of you for subscribing to the channel. Hope if you're new here, let me know in the chat how many new folks we have here. All you have to do to chat is just subscribe, and then you can chat away and let us know if you're new. And then also just smash that button. If you smash that like button, it pushes us further out into the algorithm and really helps us. Go ahead. What?
I just want to say I did a poll on the channel yesterday asking people to look and check if you were unsubscribed, if you unsubscribed intentionally, if YouTube did it, or if you were subscribed. And there were a lot of people that said YouTube had unsubscribed them. They know they were subscribed. They never unsubscribed. So every single month, YouTube goes through, and this is verifiable, factual data. It's happening to many channels, but they will unsubscribe you. And they say that they're doing it to remove bots. And maybe that is true, but a lot of real people get caught up in that blanket. So just make sure if you're on the video right now, you look down. If the subscribe button is red, you are not subscribed. So be sure you subscribe and just check that periodically because YouTube does that. And then also now you've got the bell to click to get notified. But a lot of you are saying we're not getting notifications. Hover over the bell and there's one that says get all notifications. Make sure that's selected and then you should get all the notifications as well. So they're making it very hard for us to get your content to you, but there are things you can do to help.
Moisa Kai, if I'm saying that right in our chat, just said, yes, she or he, I don't know if Moisa said, I just subscribed for the second time. Isn't that crazy? Like YouTube doesn't think you're smart enough. Like if you know what I mean? Like they're blocking this type of content and unsubscribing you from channels that cover these types of stories. And there's very, you know, so we are independent. We are independent journalists, spent 20 years as journalists on this channel. And, I've never seen anything like this before. I mean, this is the United, you know, where YouTube in the United States of America is supposed to be land of the free speech. Unbelievable.
Well, one person did say, though, that, you know, not everything is a conspiracy. YouTube is not unsubscribing people. Relax. It's you accidentally unsubscribing. So
it could be that, too.
If you are accidentally subscribing, do not do that anymore.
That's right. Kikitso says, thank you for being true journalists. Thank you so much. Smash that like button. Thank you so much. There you go. Okay, let's talk about this vaccine lawsuit. So last night on the show, we talked about what was happening up in Canada, right, where we finally got some court documents from a lawsuit around these vaccine mandates and inhibiting, you know, and curtailing travel and so forth. And the revelations were pretty eye-opening that the Trudeau government, specifically in Canada, was telling us that they were following the science, but in fact, the documents revealed that that was not the case and that the science was telling us quite something different, right? It didn't matter. So they were lying to us. Well, it's the same thing happening in the United States. And I offered this last night. I said, wait until we start to see some lawsuits in the United States around vaccines. And sure enough, turns out we have had a number of them, but most of them, if all of them, have been thrown out, okay? They've been thrown out of court. Why? For medical exemption reasons. They're just thrown out. Judges just dismissing them over medical exemptions, okay? So if it's medical exemption, if that was the reason the lawsuit was filed, thrown out. However, the first class action lawsuit over vaccine mandates was settled this week for $10 million. Now listen to this. Healthcare providers in Illinois won a class action lawsuit against North Shore University, their health system there, over vaccine mandates. Now, these were healthcare workers who were fired for refusing to comply with vaccine mandates. But they didn't do it because of a medical exemption. They did it because of religious exemptions. So stay with me. Very interesting. This is clearly the first of many of these lawsuits to come. So this case was settled out of court, which seems like a fairly obvious outcome, because how could an employer actually defend this in front of a jury, right? Like, they're going to have to pay this out, which leads me to believe we're going to see way more of these lawsuits, because they know they now can, they cannot defend this.
But you know what? This is the bad part of this, is the pharmaceutical companies intentionally put language in the bill that you can't go after them for any adverse reactions to the mm-hmm. vaccine. However, now this is all put on the people who were following the data from the government and the pharmaceutical industry to mandate this, to get these people fired, and look who's getting sued.
Right. Oh, it's not going to be Pfizer. It's not going to be Moderna.
No.
No, because of the contracts they have with the United States government, they have full immunity. Right? Full immunity. And it falls then on the government to deal with any sort of fallout. And now it's falling on employers who were being told what to do. Right? So these employers were trying to comply with, like, local, state. And so this is going to be interesting to see how far. But I'm telling you what, this is going to be a floodgate of lawsuits is coming.
But let me ask you this. Do you think that because this is happening, do you think the next time, let's say, you know, I don't know what's going to be the next one, but let's say it's monkeypox, and all of a sudden they're wanting to mandate, do you think companies will now be, after they see all these lawsuits, a lot more reluctant to go with a mandate than they were this time around?
Yes, unless the problem is that if the government forces them to. Right. And so
right. This
is the conundrum. And so I think it's going to be on a state by state basis. It's going to be on a county by county basis. And that's where this is going to get very, very interesting, based on was this, and will a judge then look at this and say, well, they had to comply with local ordinances, et cetera. And then will they be suing the state as a result? No, I'm not a lawyer. I just play one on television. So the case was settled out of court. They would have to prove, now, they had to prove that the vaccine mandates were either based on state or federal law, which they weren't, okay? Or they would have to prove that they were based on science, which they weren't. So they were based on public sentiment at the time. So that's what these companies would have had to have proven. Like, hey, this is a government mandate here. This is because of this issue, we were forced to make everyone get a vaccine, right? It was World War III. We had to do it. Well, it wasn't, and you didn't. So they were not going to be able to defend this in court. They were based on public sentiment.
Yeah, it basically became a virtue signal. It's like, I'm on the side of the government, even though, like, they couldn't get the mandate passed. So then Biden's like, well, we really strongly recommend that you still follow that guideline. So they did it. So it wasn't actually a mandate. It wasn't actually court ordered. So that's where their whole defense falls apart.
Yeah. So they were based on public sentiment and a shared belief that the vaccines were the only way out of the pandemic and the only way to protect one another, We now know that this was based on sentiment, not science, just like it was in Canada when they went through this court and we found out that, no, there was no science. You just were, you were politicking. You were politicking. Now, interestingly, this settlement includes money for employees that did get vaccinated. Hear me again. The settlement includes money for employees that went out because their bosses told them to and they got vaccinated. This should give employers nightmares. Because if you have to compensate not only the employees that lost their livelihood and lost their jobs because they did not get vaccinated, that's one thing. But compensating employees who did comply is going to run up the bill. So it also places liabilities on employers for making employees do something they might not have otherwise done. So think about the Pandora's box that this opens. So think about that. Employees who then were complying, they're like, I don't want to lose my livelihood. I have to feed my family. I've got to go out and get this thing. They're telling me to. So they go out and get it. They're also getting compensated in this class action. They're getting money. The settlement against North Shore University Health System is for $10 million. People who were fired due to the mandate will get $25,000 plus and more. And those who were not fired because they did get the vaccine can still claim $3,000. They had to have tried to claim religious exemption, and then they've been denied to get that $3,000. So they had to like show a religious exemption. They had to try at least to do it. Now, we even had Gerald Salenti on the show, a longtime friend of mine. I've interviewed him for many, many years over at when I was at Fox. But he has the Trends Journal and the Trends Report. He told me, he said, we started a church so the people could become a member of our church to get religious exemptions so they didn't have to take these mandates. That's how far people went. And then what's amazing to me is that these companies then could decide one way or another that, no, you are really a religious person, so you don't have to get it. Or, no, you're not really religious, so you're going to have to go get that vaccine. Like, it's putting the onus on these employers to make that decision about who's religious or who's getting this religious exemption or not. But I love that you had to use religion instead of, hey, maybe I want to have a baby and I don't want this in my body. And so I'm going to have a baby and my husband and I are preparing to have a baby and I don't want to go get this. I don't want to lose my job as a medical exemption. Can I not get stuck with this? Remember that employee at, she was at ESPN, right? What was her name? Allison Williams.
I'm not a sports guy, but yeah,
Allison Williams from ESPN. She was fired for refusing to get a vaccine because she wanted to get pregnant for her second child. So ESPN fired her. But that's okay. Like the religious exemption that supersedes medical exemptions, which is hilarious. So anyway, kind of back to this piece here. Plaintiffs claimed a violation of Title VII. Which prohibits workplace discrimination based on, among other things, religion. These employees tried to claim religious exemption from the vaccine and were denied. And the vast majority of legal challenges to vaccine mandates, according to a Bloomberg law analysis, are religious-based. Look at this chart. In black, 39%, 39. Religion. 5 for health considerations. 29 or 22 for both. So look at all of those. I mean, religious is the one that you're going to see a lot more of these. That means that most of them claim a violation of Title VII. That means that people have not sued against vaccine mandates claiming that they were denied medical exemption. This is interesting because right now this seems to be a legitimate case, in my opinion. We had data from Pfizer, of course, claiming a host of known side effects as early as December of 2020, right? We reported that here on the show.
Well, in question, was that a lawsuit that brought about the court denying them the, because they wanted to hide it for, I've heard 55, I've heard 75, I don't know exactly what the number was, but they wanted to hide it for a very long time. Was that a lawsuit that brought that into the Houston court where they said, no, you're not going to do that? Or was that, how did that happen?
That piece of information where it went from, Pfizer wanted to keep that data secret for 75 years? I think it was a ridiculous number of years. It was 50 or more. Like, we'd all be dead, right? And we wanted to get that information. And then the judge said no. And I think it was through that Freedom of Information Act request. And then also because of that lawsuit that we now have access, we were getting page dump after page dump after page dump. But the only reason we got that data was because of a lawsuit. So Pfizer tried to keep it quiet, right? Tried to hide it. Of course they did.
So I guess my overarching question then is the release of that data the only reason now they have any ground for the lawsuits moving forward? Like, if we didn't have that data proving that we didn't get the right information, is that the only grounds they have, or is this just the mandate thing?
I don't know about that. I mean, again, I'm not a lawyer, but I mean, to look at the fact that they were hiding this information, that they knew they had these adverse effects and they didn't report it, right? That, you know, I guess that's opening up for a class action. But again, if they have these contracts with the United States government that gives them immunity, then I guess that gets thrown out. A judge just looks at it and says, oh, you've got immunity. So the government gave you immunity here, you know? And by the way, those immunity clauses in those contracts, they're so broad. I mean, it covers like everything, you know, it's like anything we've done in the past, future, or right now is covered under this. So they can basically do anything and get protection. But this, if we know from the CDC's website and the adverse effects reporting system, maybe that opens up another round of lawsuits. I don't know. But again, if they have this immunity protection, I think these guys are fine. These pharmaceutical companies, they're going to be fine. Unfortunately, but that's what happens. And they can get away with this. So most of them claimed this Title VII exemption. This is interesting, right? Because when you have that Pfizer data from December of 2020, people with the risk of blood clots or prior stroke history or vaccine allergies, they weren't listened to. They were ignored. And when they asked for these medical exemptions, what happened? Based on their health history, they were denied. And again, I come back to Allison Williams, who was fired. I mean, here's her Instagram, right? She put it up on Instagram. I tried unsuccessfully to keep this brief and get emotional. Whether you agree or disagree with me, thanks for listening. I will not echo or harbor the hostility that some may feel toward my decision, doing everything I can to move forward and stay positive. So she wanted to have a baby and said, I don't want to get this in my body. Sorry, ESPN said bye-bye. You'd think that would have a case, right? You'd have a case at the time. There was a known risk to menstruation. We covered that on the show from COVID vaccines, right?
Oh, and boy, did we catch hell for that story.
Yeah, we did.
Like, we got emails, we got blasts. I mean, people were pissed that we talked about that.
But we got tons of emails from people that said, thank you for covering the story. I thought I was going crazy. My wife was having this issue after she got the jab, and we couldn't find any information about it. And to know then, and we were having so many people who were watching our show that said, I had that happen to me, raising their hand. I had that happen to me. I had that happen to me. Oh my gosh, my wife had that happen over and over and over again.
I know two people personally, two people personally that's happened to.
So most of these, you know, we knew about this, right? We knew about this at the time. And so you would think that you'd have a case given this information that was out there. But in most cases that have challenged the medical exemption, they would use the Americans with Disabilities Act or the ADA. Of the five cases that claimed this exemption, the ADA, two were dismissed and only three are actually going forward. So we'll see if those three, we'll keep an eye on those cases. It seems that the Title VII challenge has been more successful though, because of these religious exemptions, than the medical ones, even if they're not like a slam dunk. Most of these suits, though, are filed with requests for court orders preventing employers from enforcing these mandates. And in 22 of them, the judges shut down those and allowed the employer to keep enforcing the mandate. Listen to this. Workers have filed at least 66 lawsuits against private employers since September 2021 for refusing to grant exemptions. Judges have rejected workers' requests for immediate court orders blocking enforcement of these policies in 22 of those challenges. Courts issued temporary restraining orders in just three of the cases, which involved employers putting workers on unpaid leave as an accommodation for not getting vaccinated. Yet those workers' victories proved fleeting, as courts later denied their bids for preliminary injunctions that would have kept their employers' policies on ice throughout the litigation. So given how hard it is to win cases like this, The Illinois case is a landmark case, the one we're talking about tonight, this $10 million settlement. We're going to see.
Yeah, it sets a precedent.
Yeah. I mean, we're going to see. The thing is, though, unfortunately, because it's not then, it sets a precedent in a way. I mean, it's settled out of court. So it doesn't have, it doesn't get the stamp that a jury has decided it, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Yep.
But it does.
Because then technically you don't have a case that you can refer to because it's not a settled case. It's not like, hey, they won this. It's out of court. Therefore, it's all secretive and you can't, they won't even be able to tell the details completely of it.
Yeah, it's classified. Like we won't know, not classified. What's the privileged?
Redacted.
It's redacted.
Yeah.
It's like the name of our show. So, for instance, given how hard these cases to win, the Illinois case is a landmark case. We're going to see more like this coming up soon, like Tyson Foods. So right now we've got a bunch of these on the docket, so to speak. Tyson Foods is facing a massive lawsuit. Bristol Myers Squibb, Hawaiian Airlines, the Washington Nationals Baseball Club. They're just a few of the companies hit with lawsuits, according to Bloomberg Law Review of federal court dockets. So,
you know what? I wonder if we have a lot of people that did have adverse reactions. We've had a huge percentage of people in the polls that we've done here on the channel. I wonder if because there was the mandate and people were forced to do that, if those people, instead of suing the manufacturers of the vaccines now, will there be a way that they'll push that onto the employer now for making them get them in order to keep their jobs?
Who putting it on them? The employee?
The employer making them get it in order to keep their job. Not just the people that, you know, got let go because they didn't and now they're using their religious exemptions, but the people who actually did had an adverse reaction, kept their job, but now they couldn't do their job because they had the adverse reaction. So they end up, you know, losing their job. Can they sue because they were basically forced to get it?
Absolutely. Right? I mean, and this is going to be, that to me is the big can of worms. That to me is the next stage of this. As Dr. Yeah. Peter McCullough said, once you have the bodies start piling up, it's going to be very hard to hide it anymore. We're seeing this across Europe. We're seeing this in the UK. We're seeing this in Australia. We're seeing it in the United States. And there's going to be a few brave journalists who cover this story. They will be vilified for covering it. And I'm talking at a major publication, you know, like having a New York Times, even though I can't stand the New York Times, but having finally someone covering it from like 60 Minutes or the New York Times or something like that was going to have to do this story. You saw what happened with Amnesty International, right? When we covered that story.
Yeah.
Like Amnesty International finally calls attention to what's going on in Ukraine. And they have their big investigation what we've been saying for months on this show, and they got vilified by the liberal press, you know?
So, well, and what's really disheartening is the fact that the people responsible, the pharmaceutical industry, will not pay a dime. They will walk away. They'll probably laugh about it. Like, ha, 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 the clause protected us. It's on these companies now. It's out of their hands. They don't care. So therefore there's going to be like, they're going to do it again if they can, because it worked this time.
Well, and they'll be protected just in the way that, think about Johnson & Johnson, right? With the baby powder scandal, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's, we know what it's doing to
the
people.
Formula.
Yeah, and yeah. No, the like on the skin, the baby, the talcum powder, whatever the
oh,
baby powder.
Oh, I thought powder. You meant the.
So that, what, you know, we now know that that's causing cancer and has, you know, so they had to pull it off the shelf, right? So what did Johnson & Johnson do? They took their baby powder division and they broke it off as a separate LLC, right? So now only that can be sued in that way, and they could declare bankruptcy on that LLC that's being sued, and then they can just restructure over here, you know, and then they're fine, right? By the way, I have a real question. I'd love to know what happened to the Johnson & Johnson story, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Like, I want to dive more deeply into that, because that just disappeared. We don't hear anything about it, right? We don't hear anything about it. And it was the one, you got one dose. You didn't have to go back for two, you know, and whatever happened to that? And where are we with that story? I can't wait to have, you know, we're going to learn a lot more about that in the coming months, I'm sure. But here's a couple of things we're going to be watching for. Number one, employers defending how these decisions were made. Like, will we actually go to trial where we will hear from employers like Tyson Foods or others, and who will have to admit and try to defend why they made these mandate decisions. Number two, the availability of science-based decisions at the time. You know, what were they basing these on? Clearly, we see from the Trudeau documents in Canada that they were not listening to the science. They lied about it. And number three, availability of adverse effects at the time. Like, what was the awareness about adverse effects, and how does that play out in these lawsuits, specifically on the medical exemption piece of this? And then number four, the internal discussions, you know, at work. Like, it'll be interesting to see through discovery, like the emails from the bosses and the HR departments, when they're like on a case-by-case basis deciding whether or not somebody is religious or not. You know, what are those emails going to reveal? Mm-hmm. What sort of objections are going to pop up during discovery? Meaning, were these people who dismiss religious exemptions as, you know, were there people who dismissed them as legitimate? You know, was there a legitimate reason for them to have this religious exemption or even the medical exemptions, and they ignored it? You know, again, there's plenty of people who certainly in the military. Look at all the people in the United States military that are out of a job because they've chosen not to. And then you have Lloyd Austin, the Secretary of Defense, getting COVID for the second time this week, right? He's had to lay off and fire all of these members of the military dishonorably so they didn't even get pensions. And he's quadruple vaxxed. I think he's got two vaxes and double boosted. And he got COVID twice. And he had to lay off all these soldiers dishonorably so they don't get their pensions. So this can of worms, you know, we're not going to stop covering this story because I think it's, as some have said, this is the greatest lie of all time that we're seeing.
And speaking of can of worms, we need to watch the legislation that comes out and see if the FDA or whoever's responsible for the new bug food, we got to make sure there's not a disclaimer on chitons or however you say it, saying, you know, those are in there and we're not responsible, so you can't sue us later. So we need to watch that legislation heavy because that's probably going to be in there.
You will eat bugs. You will eat bugs and you will love it. You will love it. We did a whole story on bugs last night on our show. You got to go and check out that video we did on bugs and how the World Economic Forum, of course, wants you to eat bugs. You got to go check out that video. It's right here on our channel. We've got more news to get to.
Science.
And they are ignoring the science. It's very troubling because it causes toxicity in the body. But hey, they want you to eat it. They want you to eat cricket exoskeletons and you're going to be fine. We've got more news to get to. We're going to talk about Afghanistan and the cover-up. Did the Biden administration lie about the withdrawal in Afghanistan? New troubling details this afternoon about that. We're going to look at Germany's exit and Europe's energy crisis and what this means not only for Europe, but the world. And how the deep state and the World Economic Forum has been driving this strategy to force the poor and the middle class into an energy revolution. And they are not prepared for it, and they are totally screwed. We're going to get there in a moment. But first, I want to tell you about our friends at Audible. Huge Audible fan. And I take a walk with Grover, the dog. I'm always listening to a book. And you can get a free book right now, guys, if you want. You can get it for free just by texting the word redacted to right there on your screen. See, it says try for 30 days. Text the word redacted to 500-500 and you will get a free audiobook. Now, I recommend, I just finished reading the book Ready Player One. Oh man, it was one of the most, that was arguably one of the, like, the best time that I've ever had reading a book. I just absolutely loved it. I also have a book that I've written along with Natalie called How to Pay Off Your Mortgage in 5 Years. If you want to learn how to pay off your home in 5 years as an investor, as a real estate investor myself, we've written a book on how to do that, how to take control of your mortgage. So you can listen to that. I do the audio version of that on Audible. You can get it for free just by texting the word redacted to 500-500. You can choose from one title a month. When you sign up with them, you get one title a month as an Audible member. You can choose from their entire great catalog, including the latest bestsellers, new releases. They've got Audible exclusives now where they actually have like a whole production and the audio, like they bring a whole team of like actors and they do amazing stories as Audible originals. So I've got a few of them in my queue as well. They also have thrillers, motivation, wellness, business, and all more. in the in everything you can check out. As an Audible member, you get all of that. You get total access. I love using the app. I use it all the time. I use it on CarPlay. If you, you know, driving your car, you can use it on your Apple Watch or wherever you listen.
Those of you that might have a Sonos system in your house, I can it on Sonos because they have an app, and so you can listen to it through your whole house. Like I love listening to audiobooks while I clean or while I'm doing things around the house, and it's like a whole house experience.
And Apple's, you know, Siri, when you do that too, will actually, you can say, hey, I don't want to say the word, you know, hey, and then play my audiobook, and it'll pick up right where your audiobook left off, and it'll play it right through your Apple HomePods and all of that stuff. So works great. And you can play it on your Sonos and in your car. So our thanks to Audible for supporting what we do here and supporting independent journalism. And go get a free book right now. Text the word redacted to 500-500. How many newbies? We got a lot of new people here in the chat. I saw a lot of people saying, hey, I'm new. Yes, exactly. Chris says, stop sending money to a country that launders money for you. That's Ukraine. Exactly. IM says, I have a microchip in my brain. I don't need to listen or read. That's amazing. Are you like in the Matrix? Check that out. Hector Jimenez says, I'm new. Welcome in. Mouse Cat says, I'm new. Rebecca, I'm new. Hey, I'm new. Skeeter Bop Cat, welcome. Harry Dunn says, I'm new. Grand Emperor Putin says, hey, I have AIDS. I'm sorry to hear that. Are you new? Anton Ghost says, I'm new-ish. Rain Hazelton says, I'm new. So welcome, welcome, welcome. If you're new to the show, thank you so much for subscribing. We've got more news to get to you here. Let's talk about Afghanistan. Now, you may have seen this week was a horrible anniversary. I don't know what the term, I always bring this up because it's not, anniversaries to me are joyous, right? But here we are, the 1 year anniversary of the withdrawal of Afghanistan. And boy, did we left that country better than we found it, didn't we? Did the Biden administration mislead the American public about the United States withdrawal from Afghanistan? That's the big question today. That's what House Republicans are accusing the Biden administration of doing in a new report. Look at this. I mean, this is what we left, August 2021. So the House Foreign Affairs Committee is looking right now to how the United States, what they told us publicly. What did the Biden administration tell us publicly from the podium? What did President Biden tell us was happening? The U.S. began withdrawing in August of 2021. The withdrawal was called for by President Trump, you'll recall, right? While he was still in office, and then it was executed under President Biden. So it was carried out by the agreement signed by President Trump and then executed by Team Biden. The report was released this week, and it claims that there were more Americans left behind in Afghanistan than the White House had estimated initially. Now, the White House said that there were only 100 to 200 people left behind in August of 2021. But at least 800 Americans had been evacuated by the State Department since then. So how does that math work exactly? So the Biden administration tells us there's only 100 people left. But since then, the State Department has pulled out over 800 Americans from there. Seems off.
But if they were there, so did they live there? Why were they left? And why was it a bad thing that they were left if we were withdrawing? I don't understand why that's important, personally.
Well, it's a good question. First of all, as a United States citizen, right, one of the things that as a United States citizen you pay tax dollars for, above all else, is that the United States State Department will come and get you out of anywhere. That's literally the contract you have. That's one of the things that your passport provides. Right. And this is one of the arguments people say against renunciation of your American passport. Well, the United States government, no matter where you are around the world, if you're in a war zone or if there's something, a government collapses and there's a problem, the United States government won't forget you. We'll come get you. Right. Great. So is that a reason to keep your American passport? You know, when you're being taxed to the hilt and you're paying and you're all of your tax dollars are going to funding foreign wars, that's the reason. OK, great. Thank you very much. So I don't know exactly who all of these people were. The State Department was aware of them. because when you're traveling, your passport's registered, they know where you're going. Or maybe these people registered on the State Department's website ahead of their travel, right? So they went to this. That's what they actually ask you to do. If you're traveling overseas, the State Department actually would love it if you go to their website and you type in that you're going there, so they know that you're overseas. They can track you. They want to know that. The report says from the State Department also raises the alarm about thousands of former Afghan military personnel. So this is the more troubling piece to me. And we'll kind of get into those 800 Americans, but the thousands of former Afghani military personnel that had sensitive information about U.S. trainings and weapons and all of that, everything that we had been working with them for 20 years, right? Many of them have since fled either to Iran or other places after the Taliban came in. And the report says that these people are at risk to information security. Now, here's the top Republican of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. This is Representative Michael McCaul, who said that this report shows that there were many sins in this entire process. Listen.
There are many sins, if you will. There was a complete lack and a failure to plan. There was no plan, and there was no plan executed. And to, you know, to your point, you know, even beforehand, I think the State Department probably didn't have the resources it needed to carry out an evacuation of this size and in Normandy. They had 36 consular officers at HKIA trying to process hundreds of thousands of people. They were overwhelmed, but there are so many mistakes. The biggest one, Margaret, for me, having lived through it, were, you know, being in the classified space, listening to the intelligence community tell the story about this is going to be imminent. It's going to fall sooner rather than later. The military said it, told us the same thing. And then we went to state and they paint in the White House a very rosy picture. There's a disconnect between, you know, intelligence on the ground and what the White House is doing. I think in this report, this says it all. Like, there's no way we're going to evacuate embassy personnel from helicopters like we did in Vietnam. Yeah. And of course, we know that happened.
And what might be the biggest heartbreak about all of this is the failure to evacuate Afghan allies who should be entitled by law to live in the United States. This is the thing that really, this really pisses me off. We've talked about this on the show a couple of times. I know it really bothers Natalie as well. According to Foreign Policy Magazine, approximately 77,200 Afghans who applied for SIV acceptance are still stuck in Afghanistan today with their families, living in dangerous conditions under the Taliban rule. We fucked up their country for 20 years. And those who were able to make it to the United States, even when they get to the United States, if they're lucky, somehow, they're still living in uncertain circumstances. The House introduced a bill to give them a path to residency in the United States. Those refugees numbered in the tens of thousands. Now, it's not a competition, but the United States has already hit President Biden's goal of admitting 100,000 Ukrainians as migrants into the United States. So these 77,000 families in Afghanistan are just waiting. But they fell right behind the line to any Ukrainians that wanted to get in the United States overnight. Like, come on in. And by the way, at the border, like for instance in Tijuana and other border places, where you go to look if you are a Ukrainian, you get access to the best quality border transfer in the world. So when you walk in and you're dealing with trying to get a visa to get in the United States, there's toys for the children to play with. There's food. And the reports out of Mexico that if you're coming from anywhere else and you're trying to get a visa going through that process, it's just like a rat infested, horrible conditions, nothing for the kids, like no food. Sometimes, you're there for like 10 hours at a time and then told to come back. But if you're Ukrainian, well, lovely conditions and you get right to the top of the line, right in. 77,000 though. Afghan families, after we destroyed their country for 20 years, they can't get in and they have to go to the back of the line behind Ukrainian families.
Well, I'd like to point out a lot of those 77,000 people that have been left behind that can't get out. These were people that were working with the U.S. military. These were interpreters. These were people that actually were actively putting a target on their back to ensure the safety of our soldiers. When we pulled out, we're just like, see ya.
Yeah. Thanks for your help. Bye-bye. We don't need you. I'm reading a novel right now by Jack Carr. Have you ever read any Jack Carr novels? Anybody in our chat read a Jack Carr novel? The first one I read was The Terminal List. I just read it a few weeks ago. I couldn't put it down. Chris Pratt plays him in a new Amazon show, apparently, also. I haven't watched that yet, but apparently it's fantastic. The second book, I'm on the second book now, and boy, they really paint a picture about like how we use these people. Like, we just use them, and then we're done with them, we destroy them. The same thing that happened just in Afghanistan just a few weeks ago, right? With Zawahiri, right? We were using Zawahiri for many, many years to work with, you know, to basically launch attacks against, in Syria. And we were able to use him. And then when he used up his usefulness, we drone attack him. Right. Like, that's what we do.
Well, and that's our MO. Like, we did that when we first were establishing the United States. We used American Indians to track other Indians, to move them to reservations, and they became soldiers. They got uniforms. They got a salary. And then when all of them were in the reservations, we put them in the buggies to move them to the reservations too, took their uniforms, took their pay. And didn't, like, basically, like, you know, we used you and now we're done with you. Like, that's how this whole country was established. So I don't see why we would do anything different anywhere else.
No, and again, and I say this is not a competition, right? Like, Ukrainians versus Afghans, like, who's, you know, but let's just look at the timeline here, right? So the conflict started in February of 2022 in Ukraine, right? Where the special military operation, Russia calls it, others want, you know, call it an invasion, call it a war, whatever you want to call it. That's when it started in February, right? Where we were then suddenly fielding all of these Ukrainian refugees. The United States put up its hand and said, bring 100,000 over here. Canada said, bring them here too. You know, the UK was like, come on over here. So why do they skip the line when the conflict in Afghanistan is 20 years old? And the refugee crisis started in earnest in August of 2021, so well over a year ago, 6 months before. Again, another example of how brown people get pushed to the back of the line. It's just
it's easier to integrate people that look like us. You know what I mean? It's just easier.
And by the way, that's what we, right. What was the senator or the member of Congress that said? Or no, who was it? Was it a member of Congress or was it a British member of Parliament? I forget who said, well, let's just be, you know, they look like us. So, you know, it's easier to, yeah, it's unbelievable. The committee, the Republican committee says that it has requested more information from the Biden administration, but they have not complied and they've been dragging their feet. They say that they will subpoena if necessary. And if Republicans win the majority in November, which, come on, that's going to happen, then they intend to launch it. And I'm not advocating one way or the other. I think both parties are absolutely corrupt. But we see where things are going. They intend to launch a full congressional investigation, which is pretty toothless because these congressional investigations, what do? They don't lead to anything other than we get information, which is one thing. It's going to show how much America commits. What's that?
I always ask when they start these commissions, I'm always like, okay, what are they trying to deter us from?
Right. Yeah. So again, you know, and at least it'll give us some insights into how much America commits to the places that it invades. You know, we use them and abuse them and we're out of there. We'll steal your oil. We'll steal your minerals and resources. We'll steal your gold. We'll steal your lithium. We'll steal your uranium, your silver, your copper.
Hell, we'll even
your
steal
nickel.
Your heroin.
Yeah. And we'll leave. This is a look at Kabul 1 year later. This is a news report I want to play for you. This is 1 year later in what Kabul looks like today. And let me just set this up before I play it. The situation in Afghanistan today, okay? The economy has partially collapsed. Western powers sanctioned the Taliban regime, seizing the nation's currency reserves. We stole all of their money and cutting off any aid packages to the people. So that's been cut off. These accounted for nearly 80% of the government's budget in the country of Afghanistan. So that's all gone. The UN Development Program estimated earlier this year that acute food insecurity now affects nearly half of Afghanistan's 40 million people. So we literally created a famine, okay? Food insecurity and starvation. That's literally what we've created. And the political and social situation is just as dire. Since taking power, the Taliban leaders have set about remaking Afghanistan's society, according to Spiked Online, to their brutal interpretation of Islamic law. They have been going out extrajudicial justice to former government and military officials. They have been punishing those who fail or who fall foul of harsh laws. They have public floggings, amputations, executions. The list is endless. They have gotten rid of tons of freedoms for females, right? Teenage girls, for instance, have been barred from going to school. And in May, the Taliban chief and Afghanistan's supreme leader ordered women to completely cover themselves in public, including their faces. Those are just some of the niceties that now Afghanistan is facing. Here is a Sky News piece on Kabul 1 year later. Listen to this.
As we make our way through the center of Kabul, there is stark evidence of the deep economic crisis here. Those considered middle class now struggle to make ends meet. In this upmarket district of the capital, women wait for bread to be handed out. They're desperate. On the side of the road, people are selling their belongings.
People are bringing their household goods for sale. Everything, you know, you've got a Hoover here and an old microwave. We have car boot sales in the UK, obviously, but this is different. These people are actually bringing their entire houses for sale. I was talking to one guy who was saying that it breaks his heart because he'd actually literally cleared out the lounge for sale here. But that's because the economy is in virtual freefall. They don't have any jobs. So this is the only way they can get any money.
Selling everything in your living room. Or, as we've seen, having to sell one of your children off. That's been happening, right? One of your daughters. So this is Afghanistan today, 20 years later. The lies, the mendacity of these leaders.
Thanks, America.
Thanks, America. Thanks, UK. Thanks, NATO. I hope you'll do the same. I hope you'll leave Ukraine better than you found it.
I mean, we are a global force for good, after all, you know?
We'll shove a boot up your ass. Right, that's what we do. We'll shove an American Army boot up your ass.
And we've if you more. Don't like it, we'll sanction you.
Yeah. We've got more news to get to. We're going to talk about what's going on in Germany, the energy crisis that's unfolding, and why the deep state and the World Economic Forum, basically, this is their plan. This is their plan from the start. And they wanted this collapse to happen. And we're watching it, and the people are going to be suffering as these days start to get shorter. And it starts to get cold. So we'll have that in just a moment. But first, if you'd like to get up to 13 free stocks valued up to $32,000, you can by opening a free trading account with our friends at Moomoo using the link on the screen in the description below right there, redacted.inc/Moomoo. Now, I use Moomoo every day to check my stocks, investments, things that I hold, whether it's I invest in different gold companies, etc. I hold it inside of Moomoo. Moomoo is a NASDAQ company with a market value of $6 billion and a global user base with 18 million people. You can trade stocks and crypto and build up your financial intelligence with their amazing learning platform too, because inside of the app, they have all sorts of classes to teach you about day trading or swing trading or, you know, holding or building a portfolio, all right there inside the account for free. Remember, you're not spending any money when you open the account. You're making a deposit to activate the account. And then you never have to do anything with the account. You don't have to trade or do anything. Then it's like a bank account and you get those free stocks. And then maybe someday you're like, okay, these 13 free stocks that I got, they've gone up in value. Great. Now I'm going to sell them and take the cash and put it right back in your own bank account. So you can do whatever you want with it. Or you can invest in crypto or stocks. You can make some smart investments in some of the companies that we follow and track here that are involved in the commodity space and who are certainly bringing minerals out of the ground and who are doing some great work. So 13 free stocks valued up to $32,000 when you open your account and you make your initial deposit. I use them every day. I opened my account with like $100 like about 2 years ago. I use it, I use it every day. They also just opened up in the Australian market as well. In Australia, you'll get 180 days of brokerage-free trading for all Australian stocks and U.S. stocks. That's in Australia specifically. But anyway, get these free stocks, even if you don't do anything else with the account. I think you'll really, really like it, and you'll learn a lot too. They've got great news alerts and everything else. So just try them out. And again, it's free. So go to redacted.inc/moomoo. That's M-O-O-M-O-O. And the link is right there on your screen. That's redacted.inc/moomoo. Well, Germany is facing a dark winter as energy costs exploding right now. Nuclear power plants offline. So what is Germany going to do as we head into this very dark winter? We see Germans now also buying hundreds of thousands of space heaters because gas might not be available. It's going to be a long, cold winter. We have a guest on the show, Ralf Schollhammer. He is a journalist, academic, who's been covering this energy crisis across Europe. He's been covering the Dutch farmer revolt as well. And he joins us now to talk all about that and more. First news of the day, I want to talk about what's going on in Germany, the current state of affairs. Germany facing a dark winter, energy costs exploding, nuclear power plants turned off, although there seems to be concessions on that piece. Germans are told they need to turn down their heaters because this is how you support Ukraine at the end of the day. And if you complain about it, then you're a dissenter. you're not worthy. And you just wrote a really great piece about this, and I wanted to get your take on where things stand today. What is Germany planning to do as we head into this dark winter?
To be honest, I think they're not planning much, right? At least when it comes to addressing the structural problems at the bottom. You just mentioned correctly, there was a Wall Street Journal article just about 24 hours ago where they claimed, or what the Wall Street Journal claimed, that there is a turnaround when it comes to the three last remaining nuclear power plants in Germany, that they will continue at least into the year 2023. But now it turned out, immediately after that article was dropped, the German climate ministry denied it in its entirety. They say there is no factual basis for the assumption that these nuclear power plants will continue to operate. They say maybe there's a little bit of a concession. They say they are still kind of stress testing them. But even that is a little bit weird because the German Technical Union, who kind of does all they check the kind of equipment, they see whether or not it's still up to date, if it can still run. And they said, well, the nuclear power plants are in excellent technical condition. They're old, and we might have to talk about this as well, right? They were built in the 1960s and 1970s. So this was the last period when Germany could still build nuclear power plants. But despite their age, they are still fully functional. So the decision kind of to turn them off or not to continue them running is a purely political decision. And the background of this political decision, I would argue, is purely ideological. Right, the German government, by the way, also the quote unquote conservative government under Angela Merkel, they dedicated themselves to, you know, move Germany out of the nuclear age. And kind of we now see the results of this, because the dirty secret in the background was, sure, we don't use nuclear, right? Sure, we don't use fracking in Germany, something we might can touch on as well. But they just imported everything from Russia, right? Kind of hoping that this card they played under the table will never be a larger problem. And now we see with the war in Ukraine that the problematic nature of this policy is fully revealed.
You write about an attack on nuclear. We've been obviously seeing what's been happening at the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in Ukraine, 6 reactors, the United States largely responsible for allowing HIMARS to be targeting, and that's the latest part of this story, targeting this nuclear power plant, which to my mind, what I've been saying here on the show, is a war crime. The West is largely quiet on this issue. Nuclear is actually the least dangerous energy available, and yet Germany aimed to take it down while Russia is beginning to lead in nuclear energy. So there is this shift away from fossil fuels and demonization of nuclear that we keep hearing about. You've even had Elon Musk coming out and trying to get rid of this myth that nuclear that we should be demonizing nuclear power, right?
Yes, no, I think that's correct. And I think you can almost put a timestamp on when it happened. Kind of the green movement in Europe, but that then also, I would argue, gradually spilled over into the United States. The environmental movement that is particularly hostile to fossil fuels and to nuclear energy, that really started to emerge in the late 60s and early 70s. So it's what we would call, you know, it's, you see it a little bit also if you remember the hippie movement, right? Kind of that they wanted to live in communes and, you know, kind of in sync with nature, all these ideas that are, in hindsight, you know, it's easy to mock them. But of course, they did have an impact as these people were gradually marching through political and societal institutions, that these ideas became much more powerful, I think, that we believed originally, right? The idea was always that rationality or kind of the obvious will be victorious in the end. And as you just correctly mentioned, in many ways, nuclear energy would have been the obvious solution to many problems. But if there is a huge ideological barrier, a quasi, I would almost say religious barrier to it, then this is very, very difficult to overcome. And this is exactly, I think, what we see happening in this area.
We've seen a number of protests over the past few weeks in Germany. And today, this is an amazing story, an interview with a German news outlet, NT. We have the interior minister of Germany basically saying anybody who's protesting, whether it was lockdowns or mandates, and now he says, you know, having to turn down your thermostat and energy crisis, that you are an enemy of the state. You are an extremist. Yes. This is crazy.
And this was you said it perfectly, right? This was really kind of a Staatsfeind, to use the German word. So this is really a terminology in that way we have last heard in Eastern Germany, right? In the German Democratic Republic, so in communist Germany, if you want, and of course also in a much darker time in Germany during the fascist time in Germany. So you're absolutely right. This is, again, I'm not saying that these are the same things, but you see again the shift in the conversation, exactly what you just said. So they know that their policy of the past is about to run against the brick wall. So what you now see preemptively happening is to denounce everyone who is going to protest against it as an enemy of the state, who most likely is in cahoots with right-wing extremists, which is, again, kind of, you know, I guess we would say in the United States, we would say is basically dog whistles to say, you know, right-wing extremists equals, you know, Nazis. So this is exactly the direction which this is going. So everybody, or the second great insult that is now being spread to Germany, it means you are secretly a supporter of Putin and the war against Ukraine. So they're already kind of preemptively trying to diminish any possible criticism that aim at the consequences of these failed policies in the past. So this is really, I mean, the dark times, as I said before, they are probably just about to come. We have not reached the peak of this.
No, not even close. I mean, it seems like we're months away from maybe more widespread awareness of this, which I guess kind of gets to the heart of this question. Why do you think the Western media is largely ignoring this story?
My theory about this is kind of what we talked about a couple of seconds ago, is because most of the modern journalists have been recruited from particular that ideological cultural environment, right, that is responsible in large part for this turn against fossil fuels, from this turn against nuclear energy in the first place. I mean, we have very good polls both in Austria and Germany, right, where they ask journalists whom would they vote for. And it's about, you know, I think in Germany it's 40% would vote for the Greens, 30% would vote for the Social Democrats, 20% for the Liberals, and maybe the remaining 10% would vote for Conservatives. So it is absolutely clear where journalism I think the same is true for the United States as well, where they stand ideologically. And as you probably know, right, as both of us know, once you dedicate yourself to an ideology, you have a real problem with anything in reality that would run counter to it, that would run against it. So you can either try to, you know, find ways to explain it away. And if that is not working, you ignore it. Right? I think this is what we see when we later also talk about the protests, whether it's the Dutch farmers or in other areas of Europe as well. You simply stop reporting about it. Right? It's not happened.
It's gone completely silent. I mean, on the Dutch side, we've been covering it on our show. But it's almost impossible to really find. You can't find it on the BBC's website. It's buried. You're just not going to find this coverage. And a lot of this. Go ahead, Ralph.
No, just real quick, because to the point you made before, right? And then you have people like George Monbiot going on. I think it was either the BBC or the Guardian, where he says, "Well, we just have to accept that milk, eggs, and meat that was a luxury in the past, and we can no longer afford this in the future." Right? It's kind of this. This again quasi-religious idea. Now comes the dark time of where we have to forgo all the small pleasures of the past. When we know, and I know we're going to talk about this more in the past, we have all the technical possibilities to allow people to maybe not in abundance, but to continue the kind of consumption we have now, to what I would call, and this is always my big thing, which are the small pleasures for, you know, the lower middle class, the working class, you know, the people for whom it matters if a gallon of milk costs $1, $3, or $5. So it's easy for the, you know, quote unquote, well-funded intellectual to say, well, we can no longer afford milk, because we all know that he's able to afford it, right? He will still have his milk when he wants it. But everybody else, well, they will have to find alternatives. And this is, I think, the bothersome thing here. It's that the burden for these ideological goals, and that makes it so bothersome, right? If they would be true to their ideology and kind of also accept the suffering that would come with it themselves, I think then we can have a discussion about it. But it's always shifted to others. I mean, take the best example. You have John Kerry using a private jet to fly to Greenland and accept an environmental award. And when a journalist, honor where honor is due, right, has the guts to ask him, well, doesn't this seem a little weird? He says, well, everything I do for the climate, it entitles me to use a private jet. But, you know, the average American or the average European who maybe once a year wants to take a flight and visit a relative or go on vacation, well, this is something we can no longer afford.
Right. And this is a crisis of our own making. And of course, it adversely affects the poor. You write about this in your piece multiple times. You talk about how, you know, the extensive energy use this year in Germany, in Europe, and how this will disproportionately affect the poor. Can you talk more about that, maybe elaborating more on this particular piece of it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to give you one example, right, there are already discussions in some European countries that they say, well, maybe we have to close schools over the winter to save heating costs, right? Kind of to bring down the gas usage in public buildings, of which schools, of course, would in many cases be part of.
And so that would be great. We saw that during the lockdowns. It didn't affect children at all, right? I mean, test scores are through the roof with lockdown. I mean, give me a break. We're seeing the reverberations of 2 years of lockdowns and what this did to children, right? So yeah, now we can't heat these schools. Let's lock them down again. I'm sorry to interrupt. It's just infuriating.
No, you're right. I mean, you're absolutely right. Take the second example. Right, we live in this, and this I think is not discussed enough. I know that Malcolm Gladwell got a little bit of blowback on this issue, but I think we don't discuss this enough. There is a group of people, and I'll be completely honest, I think you and I are probably part of that group of people. We can pretty much work from everywhere, right? As long as we have broadband, a camera, and a keyboard, we can do our job. So for us, high gas prices, we can kind of avoid the fallout because we don't have to commute. But you know, the security guard, the waiter, right? People that actually have to go to the workplace and very often have to live further away from the workplace because they cannot afford to live nearby, they have to commute. So again, they are the ones, this is always the German thing and the Austrian thing, like they say, well, why can't they use their bicycle? Well, sure, and I'm serious there, but that's really the argument. They say, well, they can ride a bike. Okay, fine, maybe in May, maybe in June. November and December, it's really not comfortable in the winter in Europe to ride your bike, particularly in Central Europe.
Yeah.
But it's easy because the people who promote this don't have to do it.
Yeah, ride your bike through the Alps in January, like, and see how that works out for you. I mean, the same thing is happening in the United States. We saw this with President Biden. We saw this with Democrats pushing this green energy package, this inflation reduction package, which was a huge boondoggle for the green energy companies. And the argument is, well, I can't believe that you're still driving a gas-powered car. Like, why haven't you bought an electric car, even though the average cost of them is $55,000, $65,000? What's wrong with you? You just haven't shelled out $55,000 for an electric vehicle. What's wrong with you people?
Yeah, and if you allow me to add something a little bit provocative, and what's so bothersome is this, because in so many ways, I feel this resembles the Europe of old, right? Where you had the kind of pre-revolutionary Europe, where you had the old aristocratic class that was in some parts entirely detached from the rest of the population, which then often caused revolutions. And I feel in a way we are in a similar situation when you hear, and I think that's true in Europe, but it's also true in the United States, particularly in the current government, when you hear politicians talk, right, whether the energy minister Granholm or Pete Buttigieg, and exactly as you say, they say, well, if people would just drive an electric car, they would not have these problems. You have to ask yourself, in which reality are those people living? And it's, again, it's exactly this. It's these are two completely different classes that barely have any connection anymore. And this is, I think, very, very dangerous on the long run for any democratic system.
According to a report out this morning, Germany could be facing blackouts and a collapse of the power grid this winter after citizens have started buying up electric heaters, Of course, fears that, of course, gas is going to be cut off. And now you're hearing from public utility companies saying this is going to be a disaster because if electric heaters are plugged in simultaneously when temperatures fall, it could cause a massive overload because they use between 1,000 and 3,000 watts of energy. And if everyone switched on a fan or a heater in their home, it would mean that they would almost have to double the existing network structure on every street in Germany. So hundreds of thousands of electric heaters are being purchased in Germany. 600,000 of them were purchased in the first half of this year, Ralph. That's crazy.
No, we in the German case, we can only hope that it's going to be a very, very mild winter, right? This is kind of the last hope that there is. If it's a mild winter, if it's not going to be a cold winter, they probably can make it through. But if it should be a truly cold Central European winter, this is going to be a problem. And we still don't know. This is also the big question mark, what the Russians are going to do. There is still this possibility, right, that there might be a settlement in the war in Ukraine and that things kind of return to the pre-war status in October or November. And then these symptoms of larger problems will again start to go away because gas will start to flow. But we don't know this. But I think this is also what you see in German behavior a little bit at the moment, which in a certain sense, I don't necessarily find morally entirely worth of approval, but it makes a lot of sense politically, right? That there is hope on part of the Germans that this war is just going to end, independently of who's quote unquote winning. It just to have it being done with and to reinstall the flows of energy, because as you just mentioned, the German system, German infrastructure that is heavily underinvested is simply not prepared for such a crisis.
Well, we covered a lot of ground. I love this discussion. I could continue it, and I'd love to have you back on here. My guest is Ralph Schulhammer, again, journalist / academic. You can read his great writings. Follow him on Twitter. We really appreciate you being here on the show, Ralph. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for the time. It was fantastic being on with you.
Absolutely. And thanks to all of you for subscribing and making us a part of your regular watching. Please subscribe and smash that like button, and we will see you back here once again. Thanks, everyone.